Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And aren't we lucky? We have a wonderful group as always, and we're thrilled to have them. We're thrilled to have you. We're thrilled to meet on this Thursday morning for our August 8th conclave. We welcome you to join us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let me introduce the group to you. We will get started. Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin, is in the house. Hello, Bob.
Joe, good morning. And because I'm a ray of freaking sunshine, today is Happiness Happens Day. So I just thought I would spread a little cheer.
Now, I don't know how to take that. So that mean is that to remind us that on occasion happiness can happen, or and then we should just be aware of it, or is it a day that we should inflict happiness because of that?
Or it could be just suck it up. Sometimes happiness happens, even if you don't like it.
Oh, that's a good. It's a warning.
Yeah. It's also J.D. Vance Day, too. It's the International Cat Day. So between the two of them. So either way you go, Happiness Happens or International Cat Day.
J.P. Miller's here. We'll say hello to him in a second. He's turning off my car. No, I got an email that my lights were out of the car, which means that I probably left the car running.
And this is what the panelists do here on the round table. Whatever Joe needs.
No, and then Bob said, "Seriously, in Albany, and is everywhere all right?"
Everything's good.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Thank you.
Did you get
You're
a good
welcome.
Price for the car?
Yeah. Yeah. Did I just leave it on? Did I leave the car on?
They weren't on. There's a light from the street that's shining on your car.
Oh, so
I don't think that they were on, but I'm not a car expert.
Okay, well, I think you're enough of a car expert to know if the headlights are on.
I checked a couple times, but I'm really not.
Like, at one point did you cup your hands around the?
Yeah, and I don't know. I'm really not good with cars, so I don't want to. Yeah, I hope you'll check yourself.
Well, that's all right. Well, during the break, I'll go do shadow puppets.
Okay.
J.P. Miller is here, and obviously an extremely patient and lovely man from the Empire Report. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
To have you here, as always. CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, joins us. Hello, Heather.
Good morning. I'm thrilled to be here.
Thrilled.
I'm happy. It's Happiness Day, and it's also a very, very good day to be a horse. My horses are just beside themselves with how nice it is out.
Oh, it's cool.
It's cooler. Cool, and it's rained, so the grass is coming in nice, and the flies are down a little bit. So, you know, these are the things that I reflect upon in the morning.
It's a good day to be a horse. I just want to make a quick little announcement, a quick programming announcement. A while ago, one of our panelists, Jim Ketterer, who you know, of course, from Bard, and approached us and said, "I have this guy who's a friend. I've worked with him for years, and he's an amazing, amazing man. His name is Ambassador Robert Gassendi, and he lives here in the region, and he has the most incredible stories of being a diplomat in U.S. Foreign Service from the early 1960s to the 2000s. And the guy's like Zelig. Every time I sat in the studio while Jim was doing these interviews, and the guy was just, he's everywhere. Whenever something important happened, there he was. And he has these incredible, incredible stories. I asked Jim if he would do the interviews because Jim knows him, and I felt, you know, he would be the best person to tell the story. So over the next couple of days, 6 or 7 days, broadcast days, we're going to be playing these segments in lieu of the Congressional Corner, And I think you'll find them very, very interesting. The guy is fascinating. And if you miss one, they all sort of stand on their own because they go to different points of time and take a bite out of different timeline wine pieces. However, you can catch up on the whole thing by going online at wamc.org. But I just wanted to mention that because it's something that is a little different for us, but it's really good. Jim Ketterer did a fantastic job. Bob is amazing, was lovely and very open and just really enjoyed telling these stories. And I think it's very important that we know some of this stuff, especially as we look at our foreign policy and we discuss what's happening in the world and give us a little bit of an insight to someone who's been there for decades. So I will look forward to that around 10:45 this morning. Let's get to the topics at hand, and we will go to the news of the day. And so this is fun. Trump's complaining. Donald Trump is complaining. I don't know that this is necessarily a news story, but it's the head of the Washington Post, and it tickled me. The headline being, Trump complains about the campaign as advisors try to focus on attacking Harris. So apparently the gist of the article is that the former president, Donald Trump, is very upset about Kamala Harris's crowd size. He's very upset by the amount of media attention that she and now Governor Walz are getting. He's very upset by the polling numbers, which were indicated initially a blowout and now are really too close to call, although Trump is still leading at this moment in many of the battleground states. But the momentum of the campaign has clearly shifted to that of Vice President Kamala Harris and Governor Tim Walz. And you have the announcement this week, which of course has put them into the news cycle. And then you're going to have the actual convention, which is also going to put them into the news cycle once again. And Trump is wondering what to do, and his campaign is saying, "Well, here you go. Why don't you just go after her, and stay focused on it?" And so he mocked. Yesterday just called her pathetic, I think was the line that he used. And staffers and allies are gathering. And talking about, this is a group, by the way, real quick, this is a group, by the way, that during the convention was basically measuring the drapes and for their desk and their offices in the White House. And then things turned, and God knows, I mean, who knows what's going to happen this election? We saw a month like no other last month. Who knows what the future is going to hold, and who knows who's going to win, and I don't think anybody knows. But there was a great sense that this was a campaign that they could win. That has been lessened. And now, from the press accounts, former President Trump is a little grumbly about it. No happiness there, Bob.
Well, it brings me great happiness, Joe. So,
JP, what do you think?
Yeah, how you described the sequence of events, Joe, was spot on and beautiful. Trump did have a couple weeks after that debate where he looked like he was almost certain to be the next president. And I think he's got to be looking back on that choice to debate Biden as maybe the most consequential mistake of his campaign. Had he not agreed to debate Biden until after the Democratic convention, Biden would be locked in as the nominee, and he could then go off to victory. But so I think that he is likely very upset that he chose to debate Biden at that time. And Vice President Harris and now Governor Walz are in their honeymoon phase, and that honeymoon phase is going to last another 2 weeks. It's hard to imagine a way that Trump is going to be able to reverse that momentum. And I think he's also coming to the realization that before Biden dropped out, there was an incumbent versus challenger dynamic in the race, which is Biden was the incumbent. All of the problems with the country were resting on Biden's shoulders as the incumbent president, and Trump was the challenger saying, we can remember how great things were 4 years ago. We can go back to the way that was. There is no longer an incumbent challenger race. There is now a what I would classify as a new fresh face of the Democratic Party, which is attracting huge crowds. Crowd size does matter in a big way, and you see that Vice President Harris and Governor Walz are attracting huge crowds. And so you've got this new fresh face that America is really being introduced to Vice President Harris for the first time. She, of course, is a known entity, but she is having her coming out party now versus so it is not an incumbent. It is a new fresh face versus a former president who has always been a very flawed candidate. And so when you see Trump thinking that he's losing and becoming desperate, you're going to see him throw Hail Marys. You're going to see him. And when Trump throws a Hail Mary, they are doozies. You're going to see him level big charges. You're going to see him bring in the race card and the gender card and all those things. Whereas when it was him with Biden, you were seeing glimpses of Trump, what you might call a disciplined candidate. He was being coy and quiet and letting kind of Biden blow himself up. This race has now turned into a toss-up, and I would even say that Vice President Harris has the edge right now going into the Labor Day weekend. And we will see what a desperate Trump does. I predict long Hail Marys and attacks on her race and her gender.
There was a line in this article in the Washington Post where Trump told an ally in a phone call last weekend, "It's unfair that I beat him, and now I have to beat her too."
I love that. I mean, that's just classic Trump. I think the best thing here is that he is so used to dominating the news cycle, dominating social media, and she's better at it. And right now and I'm sure the campaign is being very intentional in talking about how big the crowds are and the size of the crowd, because those are things that trigger him. And he's it's working. And when you trigger him, he goes off message and he says dumb things and he turns people off. I mean, who in their right mind goes to speak to the Black Journalist Association and questions whether or not the Black candidate for president is really Black? I mean, when he's off message, he really messes up. And I think that's not a bad strategy by the Harris-Walz campaign to try and tick him off and get him riled up. And the whole, like, oh, it's not fair. And now he's somehow, defending Biden's, this being taken from him and characterizing that way. Nobody but him thinks of it that way. He's trying to create some kind of narrative about that. But I think that's so far off message and so far away from the things that are to his benefit. He had lots of opportunities to show that he was a new person after the assassination attempt. And for about 5 seconds, he stayed on message. And as soon as he went off message, any of the goodwill that might have accrued to him up to that point was all out the window. And if they keep him like this, if they keep him in this agitated state and people start talking about, oh, is he going to dump his VP candidate? It was a huge mistake. All of these things he takes so personally, and he turns into this sort of petulant child, oh, it's not fair. I think the whole thing is fascinating. There's so much psychology involved here. And I have to say, I think that it's been very effective so far in getting him sort of into this place where he does not look like a viable candidate to the people that he needs to get as voters.
I want to hear from Bob Griffin. I'm going to take a break just so we don't limit your time, Bob. I want to give you the full enchilada, as it were. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with our wonderful panel. Bob Griffin is here, Also, J.P. Miller, Heather Mulligan, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And we'll take a break after this message and news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Listening to the music of Alison Brown this morning. All the panel music is from the 2023 album On Banjo. Alison will be playing the Town Crier Cafe in Beacon tomorrow night and celebrating the reissue of her 1990 debut album, Simple Pleasures. And she'll be speaking with Sarah LaDuc at 11:30 this morning. You can find out more at alisonbrown.com. All right. We have been discussing the grumbling within the Trump campaign about his sort of not doing, not bringing in the crowds, not bringing in the enthusiasm that he had been prior to the change in the Democratic ticket. Just in the moments since we started talking about this, the New York Times has published a Maggie Haberman report that says that Donald Trump plans to hold a general news conference on Thursday afternoon at his home, Mar-a-Lago, the first such event he's held in months. He announced that on Truth Social this morning. Haberman writes, the former president's prominence in news coverage has slipped since President Biden abruptly announced last month that he was ending his reelection campaign and then endorsed Vice President Kamala Harris, who secured the Democratic Party's presidential nomination this week. Mr. Trump has been seeking ways to make headlines, but he has also sought to highlight how Ms. Harris has yet to give interviews and allow reporters to pose wide-ranging questions since she became a presidential candidate. Trump really hasn't done this either. When he was during his civil court case, he owned a building nearby and would go in and would answer a few questions, but that has not occurred in months. And then, of course, there's the whole back and forth debate over the debate as to whether that is going to happen or not. We can talk about that a little bit later on. Bob Griffin.
But you know what Trump hasn't been doing is that he hasn't been on the campaign trail. And you think about at least the last few days, he has ceded the pole position to Harris and Walz. And this whole J.D. Vance sort of going up and pathetically trying to measure the airplane yesterday was, I think, just shows you the continued missteps from the campaign. I think the campaign really thought that they would have an armchair run where they could sit back and let Biden self-destruct, and all Trump would have to do is to keep his mouth shut, which is in itself a huge task. And they are completely unprepared to deal with this new reality. They're unprepared to deal with the enthusiasm. I would recommend to anybody who doesn't understand what we're talking about with the enthusiasm gap, just look at the crowds between a Harris event and a Trump event. Just look what the crowds are doing within the venues themselves, and you see a level of enthusiasm that I think heartens back to sort of the Obama times, which is, you know, this is before the convention, but this is exactly the type of spirit that you're looking to see, particularly as colleges come back into play, as students get back on campus, as the race really starts to intensify. Heather, the comments about, you know, sort of Trump being Trump, you know, his ability to sow chaos, I think, will raise significant questions in some of the key constituent areas, mm-hmm. like in some of the suburbs and some of the key sub-constituencies. Like, do we really want to put ourselves, you know, through this again? So forcing, you know, the Harris switch really forces the GOP and Trump specifically to have to campaign differently, and they're not. The other element of the campaign that they'll toss out, and I'll be interested in the perceptions of the panelists and the letter writers, is I like the tone. I like the tone of, you know, the joyful warrior. Okay, we're going to be strong. And I like the way that Harris responded to some of the hecklers in the event. That, you know, she rolled with it, but she didn't bow to it. I look at some of the comments, though, coming out of Trump from some of his senior campaign officials that, frankly, are mind blowing to me. Like talking about the smell on the vice president's airplane. I'm like, what are you doing? I mean, seriously, as an adult, what are you doing? As someone who's trying to prove to the country that this organization is fit to take over the reins of power again, you're acting less than juvenile. And that's the theme that I'm seeing. And I'm looking at the polls, and you know, yeah, it's still a tight race, but the trajectory of the polls are exactly where I would want to be at if I was advising the Harris-Walz campaign. And then what we're starting to see now is the recycled attacks on, you know, the military record of Walz, on Harris, on her, you know, her American heritage. I mean, it's sort of like they're throwing. The GOP right now is throwing all of the garbage attacks that have worked from Swift Boat all the way on into the blender to see if they can find any way to stop the progression or momentum of the Harris campaign.
If you call everybody a loser and an idiot and stupid, and I mean, after a while, that loses its effectiveness, and you. Now, I say this as he's been a major political figure for 9 years, but still, in this campaign, just seems to be, okay, he's doing it again.
Yeah. What I've noticed about since Vice President Harris has become the nominee and Governor Walz has become the vice presidential nominee is that in past campaigns, the opposing campaign would gather opposition research on their opponent, and they would roll out week by week, here's something that Vice President Harris said, or this is something that J.D. Vance said, or this is something that Governor Walz said. And in the age of Twitter and Instagram, all of their past comments, the minute that they are announced as the candidate, all of their past controversial comments are distributed to everybody within 24 hours and kind of digested by everybody within 24 hours. And so what I think that another thing that Trump is frustrated with is there is not a clear line of attack versus Vice President Harris. Is she a radical liberal? Is she a flip-flopper? You know, it's hard to pin down for the Trump campaign what they're going to attack her on, whereas Biden, it was easy. He's old and senile. He's you know, he can't be the president. And so I think that's another area of frustration you're seeing on the part of the Trump campaign, which is there has not been anything uncovered in Vice President Harris's or Governor Walz's past that is really a great attack line for them. On the other hand, J.D. Vance has had a much less successful rollout than Harris and Walz in that the first 3 days of his candidacy, it was over and over new videos of him basically calling the former president, you know, a rapist, unfit for office, his supporters are deranged and all that stuff. So you've seen three rollouts over 3 weeks, Vance, Harris, and Walz. And Vance's has gone by far the worst out of those three. And Harris and Walz are they're on their honeymoon phase from now until August 22nd and beyond.
Not to say that there weren't problems prior to this, but we're looking at it as that Trump seems to be trying to hit the dartboard and just keeps picking up darts and trying to hit something that's going to bust the balloon. But I also think it is important, or at least in my opinion, there's also damage that has been done that you mentioned it, the going to the Society of Black Journalists, questioning the gender or the racial identity of the candidate that he's running against was dumb, but also had an effect. I mean, it also, I think, caused a lot of the problems. It certainly didn't fix anything, and if anything, it exposed the underlying problems that had been there for a while.
So I think everything that has been said so far is 100% correct. I also think that it would be really easy for Trump to refocus. He needs to stop looking at his opposition, stop looking at them, and start talking about the things that are causing people to be undecided. It's the economy, and with what is happening in the stock market and the nervousness about a recession. I mean, that the timing of that is an absolute gift to the Trump campaign, and they have failed to capitalize on it. I mean, he could say, oh, it's her fault. He doesn't say it's her fault. He needs to say the policies that she is part of, that her administration was part of, and those policies, those progressive liberal policies, are what is causing this uncertainty. I will correct it. And he started off, like, when asked, what would you do on day one? He said, I would cut interest rates, which, of course, he doesn't have the authority to do. But he said, and I would drill, baby, drill. People are sensitive on gas prices, and people question how fast the progressive environmental agenda is being rolled out and what is the cost to everyday middle-class Americans. Those are not bad talking points. I don't think that he handled I think drill, baby, drill. I mean, that's Sarah Palin, right? That is a mistake. She didn't win. But I do think if he could stay on message as to what he would do to make things different, focusing on things that people identify as being of concern, inflation, the cost of groceries, the cost of gas. I mean, those are real things that people are worried about. And immigration. He would have a campaign talking points that would resonate with people, but he can't help himself. He loses focus, and he goes on personal attacks. And on the flip side of it, I think Biden walls need to stop talking about J.D. Vance and, you know, did he or, you know, is he a good guy? And I mean, they've pushed back on him. They haven't done the direct attack quite the same way. But I think they need to talk about what they're going to do that is different, because that is the big question mark, right? They're a continuation of the Biden administration, theoretically. How do they change course and get rid of inflation, you know, get the economy in a strong position, and ensure that that it's not a complete progressive agenda? And, you know, I think that's where they should be, but neither campaign is really there.
No, but I also think that with Trump, the problem is that, I mean, he's been thin on his policy statements to begin with. Yeah. And, you know, he got caught with his pants down around at the Project 2025. I mean, whether he wants to own it or not, he owns it. I mean, that's him. The Harris campaign, I think, needs to address the issue of the kitchen table. I think they do need to address the issue of food inflation. I think they need to I think they need to lay out what their plan is for health care. I mean, if immigration is a winning topic for the GOP, then healthcare, access to healthcare, certainly getting into reproductive freedoms, protecting even things like contraception, is something that she needs to be hammering home every single day. It's the potential loss of these freedoms, but it she has to stay, or I would prefer that she stays positive, and lay out these are what we're going to do. I'm not sure that he can do that.
No, I don't think he can do it effectively. I think that there are topics that if he could stay on message,
he'd be fine.
You know, he'd be fine. And I would push back on the Heritage Foundation thing being wholly owned by him a little bit, because they've put together this report for every incoming Republican, you know, potentially incoming Republican president. And while it definitely reflects some of the policymakers that have his ear, I am fairly certain that he didn't sit down and have long policy conversations with them about what should be in there and what shouldn't be in there.
Well, it's a safe bet because I don't think he sits down and have long policy
exactly.
statements.
Exactly. That's why I'm confident.
But the Heritage Foundation, if you look historically, their policy documents have driven the modern GOP.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if you think about their undue influence on the court selection, if you think about their influence on campaigns, on the movement of the GOP to beyond the right where I think most people are comfortable with, this is all the Heritage Foundation.
No, I get that. And okay. They've always had stuff in there that hasn't gotten done, that has been rejected by... Well,
thank God.
Agree. But I guess that's my point is when President Trump says, hey, listen, I didn't write this. And that is true. It is a policy document that very frequently has provided a lot of guidance to Republican administrations, but it certainly isn't a wholesale. This is our policy. Never has been.
But this is so interesting to me. But this is Trump in a nutshell, though, right? What Trump comes out and says is that I don't even know these people.
Yeah, no, okay? I right.
I have nothing to do with it. I don't know what this is. I have never even heard of this. Oh, by the way, there's a picture of you on the plane with a guy from the Heritage Foundation. Okay.
Okay, but that's like a 20-minute flight, to be fair.
Got you. But they're discussing the creation of this report. Mm-hmm. Also, J.D. Vance saying that J.D. Vance writing the foreword to the book by the guy who wrote the report. I mean, how momentous that is, I have no idea. It doesn't probably not. But you can't then also say we have nothing to do with it. We had no idea that was in the closet.
No. I agree with you. I'm not suggesting that there was absolutely no sense of this going on. Certainly they knew. This is something they've done for every incoming Republican administration. So it's not like it's news to them that the Heritage Foundation will be putting together a policy document. Does that mean that he knows that it says, and we're going to, do X, Y, and Z? Probably not. I just don't see him being engaged in that level of detail. And I don't know, J.D. Vance, I mean, in conservative circles, somebody writes a book, says, will you write a foreword? I don't think that means that he wrote the Project 25 report. I'm not even worried about J.D. Vance. I feel like he's such a disappointment. He was such an authentic person some time ago, and he seems to have just like completely turned around and taken on the Trump mantle, despite the fact that he thought the guy was horrible some period of time ago. So that just tells me that he's an opportunist, and I think that people see that for what it is.
JP?
The Heritage Foundation, I always thought of the Heritage Foundation as being old school Republican, free market, strong military. And I kind of wonder whether the Heritage Foundation is influencing Trump or Trump is influencing the Heritage Foundation, in that the Republican Party that I saw during the convention, I saw a labor union leader speak and talk about how evil corporate interests are. And saw him being cheered at the Republican convention. That's something I had never seen before. I see a more protectionist, less free market Republican Party, much more of an, let's not have free trade throughout the world. Let's have protectionism in the United States. That is not what the Heritage Foundation has been espousing for 20 years. I don't know if that's what they're espousing now. And also with regards to foreign policy, I see a Republican Party who is talking about ending the war in Ukraine and having less of a presence militarily rather than having more of a presence militarily. And that's something also that historically the Heritage Foundation has not been for. So I haven't read Project 2025. I don't know whether those are values that are espoused in Project 2025, which is free market or what their foreign policy is. But my view is that Trump has remade the Republican Party. He has cobbled together a new coalition of voters and much more focused on working class Americans. And I don't see the Heritage Foundation as being responsible for that. I see Trump and Trumpism and MAGA as the new movement and what's cobbling together that coalition and what's pushing forth those policies. And I don't think that they have a specific policy agenda. It's more of what's popular and what does Trump think is potentially good for him and good for the party at that moment, not a overarching view.
Quick break. We'll be right back and take your letters. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Good morning. Welcome back to The Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, Heather Mulligan, Bob Griffin, and J.P. Miller. We have letters. Let's go to those. And the time before we go to the break at the top of the hour. Kathleen says, please, panel, every time you say this is a tight race, please make clear that this is because of the Electoral College. Kamala Harris will win the election by millions of votes, as did Hillary Clinton and Al Gore. This country as a whole does not support the Republican Party and their extreme agenda that would decimate the middle class. That is true. However, when you look at the battleground states and where the Electoral College matters, it's still a close race.
So I've said it on this show before. We need to think about rethinking the Electoral College and actually apportioning the votes in each state based on how the votes are cast. It would put every big state in play, even the blue ones, which is why, I mean, the states would have to do this at their own state level. But it would keep, it would basically keep the promise to the smaller states that they get an oversized vote, that being like your Vermonts and Maines and whatever, because they get an Electoral College vote for each senator. Despite the fact that they have very small populations. So it would keep that promise, but it would put every state in play. And by the way, it means that people who are in the minority in that state, their vote would actually count for the first time.
Voice. Yeah.
But, you know, instead we talk about compacts. Oh, we're going to cast all of our Electoral College votes the way the popular vote goes. And you know what that does? That disenfranchises the people in your state who did not vote for that candidate. And so, but this is something, you know, the elected officials would have to agree to do this. And these states that have, you know, single party rule, which are a lot of the red states and a lot of the blue states, are never going to give up that percentage of the Electoral College votes for the people who are not in their party. And that's really unfortunate.
And we need politicians that come out and say they're going to accept the results of elections.
Absolutely,
too,
yeah.
Which is, you know, we didn't really go back to Trump's comment about I beat Biden. And that should be terrifying to all of us because he didn't beat Biden. So the idea that you know, He keeps saying these things, and I begin to think that he actually believes his lies, which leads me to question, you know, his cognitive capacity. Certainly, JP, one of the things I think was really interesting about your comments is, you know, the Trump administration was going to run against Biden's age.
Yep.
Okay. Now the script is absolutely flipped, and this is something that I think Harris can raise is that, you know, that he being Trump is unable to keep up with the demands of the job. And I think you see this with the fact that he's not on the campaign trail right now. That yeah, it's all well and good that he's gonna hold some presser down in Mar-a-Lago. But you know, again, it's I question whether that really helps the campaign and if anybody really pays attention to that besides folks like us.
So I'm just going to, you know, the youth thing is interesting. I have a son who's very interested in this election and loves RFK Jr. You know, I mentioned the bear thing to him and he's like, ah, that was 10 years ago. You know, like for him, 10 years is a really long time ago, right?
But, oh, you know, that bear had lived.
There's all this YouTube stuff, RFK Jr. doing like chin-ups and he's super fit. And so, while Biden was still in the race, he's like, how can I vote for either of these guys? Here's a guy, like he's in good shape. He's you know, he's healthy. He's got this kind of youth vigor about him. And that was really appealing to him. And by the way, the whole environmental you know, background. He's like, yeah, like this guy, he was an environmental law attorney. You know, how could, you know, how could anyone think he's not qualified? So it's an interesting perspective. And I do think that the Harris Walls should figure out a way to demonstrate their own energy, kind of vigor, all the things that Trump always kind of pounded his chest about. And they can do that without, you know, questioning. I mean, I'm sure some third party funded campaign is going to put out pictures of him looking like overweight on the golf course and missing a swing or whatever. But aside from that, they should show how robust and sort of energetic they are as part of their campaign.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. News is next with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. I'm Joe Donahue. Heather Mulligan is here, Bob Griffin, and J.P. Miller. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We have a number of letters. I want to get to them. People are very anxious to talk about the issues that we have brought up so far in our first hour. I do want to just put another item on the table to discuss, and then we'll talk about it a little bit and then go back to letters. But we've brought it up in passing, but not look at it head on, and that is Governor Walz was announced as the candidate on Tuesday, and here it is Thursday morning. Yesterday, day after the big event in Philadelphia, the attack from the GOP and specifically from J.D. Vance was about Governor Walz's military record, accusing him of avoiding a tour in Iraq. Vance of Ohio also claimed Tim Walz of Minnesota had exaggerated his service record. Mr. Walz said a decision to retire and run from Congress came months before any notice of deployment. The argument seems to be here that Mr. Walz, who had a career in the National Guard for 24 years, at one point had the opportunity to start running for U.S. Congress. And the way it's being painted by Republicans is that he deserted his fellow soldiers to avoid serving in Iraq because he retired from the National Guard in May, several months before his artillery unit received orders to deploy there. You abandoned your unit right before they went to Iraq, Mr. Vance said. Mr. Walz has said that he knew nothing of the deployment prior to his decision to leave his unit. I'm wondering, Bob, how big an issue you think this can be.
I think they're trying to resurrect the attacks that worked so well on John Kerry. The Swift boat attack, even though Kerry was a decorated war hero, I think there's a couple of issues that dragged this down. One is that the tenor in the country and the news cycle is different than it was when the attacks on Kerry were so successful. I also think when you look at you know, J.D. Vance is in a non-combat position, so it's interesting that he's got to be the attack dog, but he has to be the attack dog in this because, you know, Trump used his bone spurs as the excuse to get out of the Vietnam War. So you actually have somebody at the top of the ticket who manipulated the system in order to stay out of the draft. So Vance is the only one that can actually leverage this attack. I don't think it's going to be ultimately successful. This was a recycled attack that was used 6 years ago on Walz. When you read the comments from other folks in his units, they praised the work that he did. Joe, he served 24 years. The other limitation that he would have had if he had stayed in is that with the Hatch Act, it would have reduced or almost eliminated his ability to run. So, right now they're just throwing what they can, you know, against whatever attack they can come up with to see what sticks. I don't think it's going to stick.
We get this letter from a listener who says, throwing stuff at the wall to see if anything sticks is a time-honored strategy, especially in politics. And while Trump personally is unhinged, his campaign is being run by skilled professionals. So I wish your panel would not lose sight of how this campaign will play out from September through November.
I agree. We are a long way in real life from the election, and longer than ever. This stretch of time is longer now than it was 4 years ago because of the news cycle is so quick and turns over so quick. So the question is, what is going to stick? I mean, so far the cat lady thing has really stuck, which is funny because that was something he said J.D. Vance said some years ago. It's not even a this campaign thing, but there's lots of people who have cats, So.
But he doubles down on it.
But he doubled and tripled down.
That's just... I think that if they could keep their candidates on message, there are some messages that would resonate, but they can't.
I think this is going to be an interesting sub-story to watch is, will Trump allow the professional campaign staff to run his campaign? And if there's any truth to the rumors that, he's whining and complaining right now about where things are at, his knee-jerk reaction will be to ignore the advice of his professional staff, which has got us things in the past like, you should inject bleach for COVID.
Exactly.
I mean, these are the things that this is where when he goes off the track, it's of epic quality. And that's where if I was one of his campaign managers, JP, I think you said it right, or Joe, I don't remember who said it, about measuring the drapes. They were measuring the drapes in the White House, and this whole thing has flipped on its head.
Right. Yeah. JP?
I think that they are relatively effective attacks on Governor Waltz in terms of him leaving before they went to Iraq. I think there are some members of his division that were disappointed by him leaving before they went to Iraq. There are also, I think, some old videos of him talking about carrying guns in a combat situation when he was never in a combat situation. And it does harken back to the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth against John Kerry, which were effective. I think, though, that in the whole, people look at his record of 24 years of military service, which is 24 more years than I've ever done and more than 24 years more than the vast majority of Americans have ever done, that these are, if that's the best that they have, and I think it is the best that they have, I don't think it's that effective. I would also say that at the end of the day, the election isn't going to be decided based on people's opinions about J.D. Vance or Governor Waltz. The election is going to be decided based on people's opinions on Kamala Harris and Donald Trump.
There's also a record, Joe, that if you look at what he did as a congressman, I think is he's been very pro-military, very, very pro-veterans, the veterans' benefits. And so he actually also has that history of support for the military that I don't think will go unnoticed.
Let's go to letters, and we have a lot of them, so here we go. John says, Kamala Harris is getting the messaging about how food and gas prices are still high and what she would do with it. She would enforce the antitrust laws that have been hung up in Congress. Big food and big oil need to stop price gouging, and she would address that. So if Trump rants about the cost of food, it gives Harris even more opportunity to get her messaging out. Then we go to Linda. With all due respect, I do love the panel. This is not a normal election. Trump believes he will win the election due to corrupt poll workers, electors, and his, quote-unquote, judges. The Republicans do not believe in democracy, says Linda. Then, Mark, I think that the panel gives Trump too much credit for having an agenda. I think his agenda is to get reelected, to stay out of jail, and the use of the presidency to line his pockets. Stephen Miller and the gang will do the work of dismantling the government. Trump could care less as long as he's making money.
It's an interesting point. If could we just talk for 1 second about, you know, the Trump floor, though, is pretty high. The question is, what's the Trump ceiling? And I do think the election is going to be about not only the swing states, but that 8 to 10% sort of in the middle that's going to swing, that's going to decide for everybody else. Otherwise, the two sides, I think, are pretty much are pretty much set on how they feel. I mean, there's nothing that could happen that would make me vote for Donald Trump. All right, so I mean, just put that out there. But again, I'm not the person that the campaign needs to talk to. They need Heather. They need to talk to your son. They need to go to those folks. Those are the people. Which means that there's a very small population that's going to get a lot of attention, you know, coming up.
Well, I think that, I mean, that's 100% right that it's the undecideds, and I think the undecideds, in many, if not most instances, would describe themselves as moderates. And I think both campaigns made strategic mistakes in choosing their running mates, because what they did is double down on what I think is one of the concerns that moderates have, right? So Trump, rather than, you know, going with a more moderate Republican running mate or a person of color or a woman, went with someone who basically just reinforces his base. I feel as though Kamala did that a little bit also, not to such a degree, but I do think that, you know, some of Walz's advocacy as governor suggests that he is much more progressive than some of the other potential running mates that she was considering. I think that for the folks that are in that swing 20%, having, you know, a Pennsylvania governor or an Arizona senator on the ticket would have been more a nod to the moderate part of the party. And the narrative about rejecting the Pennsylvania governor because of concerns that he is Jewish and they're going to lose the part of the progressive wing that is anti-Semitic or anti-Israel, that is concerning. I mean, that's something, if that narrative continues to move, that's gonna be a major concern for a lot of people, because there really is a question mark about how progressive really is Kamala Harris. She's got some great credentials as a former prosecutor. I mean, she's certainly. I laughed when someone suggested she was not qualified. I'm like, I'm sorry. She was a senator. She was vice president, and she was a prosecutor elected. I don't even understand how you could argue that person is somehow less qualified than someone who only ever ran a real estate business. So, but I mean, going back to my point, which, wow, I'm long-winded today. But I think that if they had either side had chosen someone more moderate than themselves, they would be more appealing to that middle. And that is now off the table. So the question is, what is it that's going to move people? And I think it's the economy, it's immigration, it's reproductive rights. And how do you capture that in a way that looks like you're also not just continuing to divide?
And also, that's a great point, Heather. I agree with you. The other thing that is the X factor, which we don't know, is what is the global news? What's happening in the country those 10 days leading up to the election?
Yeah, yeah.
Is our economy off to the races and inflation going down? Is our economy tanking and inflation's going up? Is there a global event, a terrorist attack? Those factors of what happens in the last 10 days really have historically shown how they shape moderate and undecided voters who can get that last push of momentum going into election day. And also, is the election that close going into election day where that matters?
Some more letters. Joe writes, what does the panel think about the climate change denial of the Republicans in the face of daily headlines about wildfires, flooding, heat waves, etc.? Does climate denial continue to be a winning position?
That's they already, the Democrats already have them. So there's not, the Republicans know they're not going to get the folks that have climate change as the top of their list as a major concern are not going to vote for Republicans. So, or they're not going to vote for a Trump administration, let me put it that way. And so I don't know that that is a topic that will win the day. Now, you know, a major, you know, weather event, you know, right before the election, you know, maybe that gets more people thinking this is an urgent thing I need to vote about. The problem with climate change is it's a long game. And it's just, it doesn't have the same kind of urgency as, you know, a 30% increase in your grocery bill, as far as something that people will vote on.
Although if I'm Harris, I don't want to be talking about electric vehicles.
Right.
You know,
don't need to.
No. There are certain issues that I don't think have been either messaged correctly or understood by the vast majority of the public. So it's been allowed to be painted as an extreme position. So there are some things that if I were her, I would you know, not try to tread there.
Just keep your head down and create the incentive environment to, you know, create incentives for adoption in a way that doesn't appear to be taking something away from people.
And JP, your comments are really spot on, because you start to think about the tension right now between Iran and Israel. You know, and you can see where an active war in the Middle East beyond just the Gaza situation is going to potentially flip the script on what position we take on our military, especially if you start if people start to realize that China and Russia are supporting, you know, the Iranian efforts. Or if you start to see a number of U.S. casualties, like we saw some injuries this week from attacks on our bases in Iraq, the whole situation in Ukraine could also flip. So I do think, you know, there's going to be both planned, quote, October surprises and unplanned events that are going to continue to change the way this race goes.
So, you know, I've been taking note of the fact that in the last couple of days, I've heard a number of stories about planned terror attack at a Taylor Swift concert,
yep,
but also someone who was intercepted entering the country who had a list of prominent people that he was going to assassinate. I mean, I do think that, you know, some kind of terror attack, were it to happen between now and the election, will influence, you know, people's views on who's a more suitable president in the next term. So there's always wild cards.
We got this from Johnny, who writes, a man enlisted for 24 years of his life, 24 years. And the criticism leveled against him is he never was put in a position to risk his life. This is disparaging service of a veteran. I don't care who you are or what your motives are. This is some extremely low behavior, especially when the men at the top of the ticket, took the coward way out when he was called to serve. That from Johnny. Then we go to Laura, who says interviews with swing voters in swing towns and swing states showed they are voting for Trump for economic reasons, with his personality and previous actions having no influence on their decision. That's extremely unfortunate. The danger he poses is being ignored. Mm-hmm. Then we check in with this letter writer, Dixie. Why can't we simply go with one person, one vote, and eliminate the Electoral College?
Because it'll never get through as a constitutional amendment.
Jacqueline says, I'm waiting for some outrage from the media about J.D. Vance's audacious performance yesterday. He should have been taken down by the Secret Service. Did he head over to the plane?
Yeah, but Yes, he did, but it was creepy more than illegal in my mind. I mean, yeah.
he was also with his own Secret Service, but yeah. it was a weird movement. You know, those tarmacs are long, so he had like a long walk out there, and you know, I don't think it was well thought out. It wasn't effective. Whether it's a negative, I don't know, but. It definitely looks, and he's speaking as the motorcade comes up, so it kind of looked like he was she was clearly the more important person on the tarmac than J.D. Vance.
You know, now, it would have been really funny if a window in the back went down and the finger went up, but I think that was just a missed opportunity. The other thing, too, for the letter writer, what's the Secret Service going to do? Are they going to tackle the vice presidential candidate for the GOP on the tarmac? No, they're not going to do that. I mean, It was creepy, and again, you know, the now we have weird and creepy with JD.
Let's see, 3 minutes and five letters, so we'll see what we can do here. Ann says, now Trump is reading social media trash and saying that Justin Trudeau could be Fidel Castro's son. Somebody probably started this as a joke. Trudeau's mother met Castro years after Trudeau was born. By the way, she was with her husband Pierre at the time. She should sue Trump for slander. There's a lot of garbage spewing from this man. Can we just please make sure this crazy old retrobate is soundly defeated in November and consigned to the midden heap of history?
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I think, wasn't there a rumor also that she had a friendship with Mick Jagger?
Who hasn't?
Well, now you're affecting my self-confidence, Joe, because I haven't. So what's wrong with me?
How long can Trump still have the edge, writes John? Huge crowds, convention coming up, and messaging from the Teamster boss and others in Detroit. There should be enough undecided voters that are going to give Harris and Walz a sizable lead in the coming weeks. We shall see, but this remains a divided country. We should not forget that. And
Joe, I'll go back to something we say almost every week. I'm not sure the pollsters understand how to poll right now in the current environment. That's why I talk about trends rather than specific polls, because I don't disagree that, you know, in my mind, I think this thing should be a runaway for Harris Walz, but I don't believe it is.
And this from Diana before we take a break. Before this, I was sick and depressed about the upcoming election. It feels like an incredible weight has been lifted off my heart with the nomination of Kamala Harris. I am so thankful for her fearlessness and intelligence and lack of fear. She gives me faith in this country's future. That from Diana. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue and we'll wrap up the program and have our last go-round with this terrific group. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And you think we got problems? Let's talk about Great Britain. Great Britain is seeing violent riots, and we'll talk a little bit about what we know so far. On our panel, we have about 10 minutes or so left with this group, and we'll make the most of it as we talk about this story. Officials had braced for more unrest on Wednesday, but the night's anti-immigration protests were smaller, with counter-protesters dominating the streets instead. After days of violent rioting set off by disinformation around a deadly stabbing rampage, the authorities in Britain had been bracing for more unrest on Wednesday, but by nightfall, large-scale anti-immigration demonstrations had not materialized, and only a few arrests had been made nationwide. Instead, streets and cities across the country were filled with thousands of anti-racism protesters, including in Liverpool, where by late evening, the counter-demonstration had taken on an almost celebratory tone. Over the weekend, the anti-immigration protest organized by far-right groups had devolved into violence in more than a dozen towns and cities, and with messages on social media calling for wider protest and counter-protest, the British authorities were on high alert. With tensions running high, Prime Minister Keir Starmer's cabinet had emergency meetings to discuss what has become the first crisis of his recently elected government. Some 6,000 specialist public order police officers were mobilized nationwide to respond to any disorder, and the authorities in several cities and towns stepped up patrols. In Bristol, the police said there was one arrest after a brick was thrown at a police vehicle and a bottle was thrown as well. So where has the unrest taken place? Protesters over the weekend took to the streets of a dozen cities across Britain, most of them in England. Trouble broke out from Aldershot in the south, of Sunderland in the north, and Liverpool in the west. Belfast in Northern Ireland was also drawn into the fray. Arrests having been reported from Bristol and London and Belfast to as far north as Sunderland. And what set off the protests? The unrest began after a teenager wielding a knife attacked a children's dance class early this week in the seaside town of Southport, which is near Liverpool. Three children were killed. Eight were wounded. The suspect was born and raised in Britain, but online rumors soon circulated that he was an undocumented immigrant. To counter those false claims, the authorities took the unusual step of publicly identifying him. The BBC has reported that the suspect's parents are from Rwanda. The police have not disclosed a motive for the stabbing attack.
So a couple of interesting developments here. One, I will admit that I think there needs to be a thorough investigation into the spread of violence, because there's a feeling of orchestration to me that I hope the UK officials will watch carefully, especially given the fact that there was a sweeping change in the national politics, where Labour came back into power in a huge way, and all of a sudden this occurs very early into the tenure of the new Prime Minister. What also is really interesting to me, though, is what the people in the cities have done since the far right created the chaos in the riots, and is that is just regular people have taken to the streets to take their communities back, which I think is just a fascinating sort of shift than what I normally would have expected, which is the riot police to go in and the thugs and the police to you know, fight it out in the streets, and you watch the tear gas and the throwing stones, and once they tire each other out, they sort of go to the pub and move on. But in this situation, I think the counter demonstrations did what the police couldn't, and sent a real clear message about where these communities feel what they feel and what they believe. This is a lesson, though, that I hope our own law enforcement are watching very carefully, because it's the type of orchestrated political violence that I think should be planned for, or we should be ready for it. I hope it doesn't occur, but we should be ready for it, both pre-election, post-election.
Heather.
No, I agree. To me, the thing that made the biggest impression on me is how scary it is that this could be organized so quickly on social media in so many places. It's not, you know, this is not one city focused on just where this occurred, and obviously a terrible thing. I think finding out the motive and getting that out there might be kind of a critical thing. I have no idea what could possibly motivate anyone to do something so awful. But if we can take away the narrative that was spread on social media and get a little more information out there, it might diffuse some of it. But to me, the biggest thing is how scary it is that these kinds of very violent protests could be organized on social media so quickly.
Well, and there's a benefit, right? You, if you think about it, you know, you create chaos, you blame the chaos on the liberals.
Right.
And then you run on tough on crime.
Right.
You know, and it sort of becomes this cycle. And this is where I'm wondering about who's sort of funding the overall organization, who's pulling the strings on this. At the same time, it's not difficult, and we've seen in our own country for people to want to engage in violent behavior because they think it's fun.
Yeah, but I can't see that happening in multiple cities without some, you know,
orchestration.
Right, yeah. Right. So, the social media aspect of it is really concerning.
Anything you would like to add to that?
No.
All right. Then let me just ask, this is a listener question, and I think it's a good one. And I'll be for whoever wants to answer it, Bob. John. John says, it would be advisable for authorities here to be ready for the same thing after Trump loses in November. If you don't ask your Homeland Security expert a question like that, who do you ask? Right.
I absolutely think that our officials would be remiss if they aren't red teaming very similar scenarios. I also think they'd be very remiss if they weren't watching how the information flowed, because the pop-ups also were intended to pull resources. If you start to think about the idea of self-supporting resources, stopping the police from and law enforcement from being able to move resources to self-support because of so many areas being in unrest. This is a blueprint that we would be remiss not to pay attention to.
Yep.
Anybody else? No?
No, okay. He's the smartest guy on this one.
So there.
Hey, thank you.
So there. All right. all right, we're gonna end a few minutes early. Again, we have coming up, we have a very interesting conversation with Ambassador Robert Gassende. That'll be coming up next. And Jim Ketter, our panelist, and from Bard, and an interesting guy in his own right, interviewing and talking to this man who served as a diplomat in the U.S. Foreign Service from the early 60s to the end of the 90s. Just so you know, I'm going to go check my car.
It's funny why your spotlight is on it.
Not because I don't trust JP. But JP's wife doesn't trust JP. What did she say?
She texted me. She said, are you sure Joe's car was off? That may be not your skill set.
Well,
it is what it is. Yeah.
I feel better. Okay. thank you all very much for being here. It's a great pleasure to have you. And always wonderful to get the time to have you all together to talk about these issues. We'll be back right after this.